Awesome. All right. Well, thanks, Dave. Really appreciate you taking the time in to come on and speak with us about the legendary Bob Nalbandian. And, you know, anybody who's familiar with Bob and his career, of course, knows how close and connected he had been to you guys in the Megadeth camp over the last 40 years. And right. So I know you've obviously got plenty of memories that you've obviously shared experience with him. But before we get into your history with Bob and what he's done for Megadeth, especially in the early part of the band's career, I mean, you've obviously presently got a lot going on with your current career. Mm-hmm. Let's start with the Lucid. I mean, you guys obviously just dropped the new single Risk Machine, third one off the upcoming EP Saddle Up and Ride. So go ahead, David, and I guess fill us in on all the happenings with the Lucid, the new EP, and then guess what we can expect to see in the future with the band.
So we're like the world's greatest internet band, and I say that because we've never gone out and played a show. We tried last year. Unfortunately, our guitar player Drew had a cancer scare, and he got through that, so everything's good. And that gave us a little more time. The EP was basically done. We were still mixing it, so it gave us a little time to kind of make sure we got that, you know, finished up properly. And so the first album came out in October 2021. And so we put the songs out, then we put the videos out, and, you know, then we intended to do the shows, which had to be, you know, pulled off the calendar with for his health reasons. But sure. Everything's good. Drew's fine. And so he kind of works full time on this and, of course, making horror movies and other stuff that he does. So, you know, it's funny with the Lucid. I told him, I said, man, I've got this King of the Thrash stuff, you know, teeing up here for the new year and, you know, on the tour. And we got a live album that's coming out in Cleopatra here in March. So I said, look, there's a window and it's basically December. It has to come out. At least they sort of announce it, get it out. The record's actually going to come out in 2 weeks on January 27th. And it's a five song EP. So, you know, as everything with the Lucid, it's kind of, you know, counter culture to the typical protocol of the music business. Right. And that's by Drew's design. You know, he's just got good instincts with it. You know, we shopped it around to some labels, and they're mostly the metal labels. And of course, this wasn't their cup of tea, you know. So it's funny how we knew we had a really good album, you know, and it's a really good band, and we make really cool, fun music. But it's, you know, it doesn't really slice into a genre. So, you know, labels are all about, they're basically marketing tools, right? So they didn't really, I don't know, where do we put this, you know? So, mm-hmm. So it's funny that since it's come out, people love it, you know, they really like it. You can just tell by the reaction to it. It's something it's fresh. It's always unexpected. And so the first single, I told Drew, I said, dude, why don't you just drop it like, you know, the day before the Christmas weekend? I said, the music industry is shut down. You know, the industry shuts down pretty much, as you guys know, by about mid-November. Sure. Mm-hmm. You know, there's no more ads at radio. You know, no one in their right mind would throw a bunch of money behind a record heading into the holidays because everybody's going on vacation. So since, you know, we're basically an internet band, you know, we can do whatever we want, you know. So I, you know, of course, there's not much news going on through the holidays. So I said, well, fuck it. Let's make some headlines. We'll blow the shit up and drop songs during the holidays. So the first one that had Violent J from Insane Clown Posse, I think that got a rise out of everyone. They're like, whoa, you know, we never saw this coming.
Yeah.
I love that. I love that, you know, story of my career, you know, just fucking blow people's minds, you know what I mean? So I've kind of gotten used to it now. So that's, I thought that was fun. And then, you know, we decided right before New Year's, we would drop the second single. Which was very cool because that song, you know, we were kind of figuring out how to do it. I got on the phone with Drew and Mike Heller, our drummer. And I said, you know, it needs this kind of, not Chili Peppers, but this kind of Incubus funk kind of thing, you know? And after we agreed to it, I sat down with my bass and really came in here and just picked my bass up and started, you know, getting my 80s, you know, funk groove on and got to play bass in a very different way. You know, usually people hear me with a pick playing thrash metal, all that stuff. But I actually do know how to play bass in many other genres and many other styles. And so it's fun that in that band, I can do all that, you know? We learned years ago, probably the Risk album being the perfect example. It's hard to bring all things in under one umbrella, especially when a brand has sort of been established. So I think for me, having Ellison Soto, the Lucid.
Where'd he go?
Death record. Dieth record will be coming out. You know, I've kind of got the four pillars of my life that hold the roof up over me, you know? So the Lucid, you know, it's got its corner, you know, and it's fun because we can kind of do whatever the hell we want with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Well, speaking, you know, the earlier part of Megadeth's career, as I said before, Kings of Thrash featuring you and ex Megadeth guitarist Jeff Young. You guys obviously are out, going to be playing the albums Killing Is My Business and Business Is Good and So Far So Good So What in its entirety, which is great, man. I know you're gearing up to hit the road next month for a long East Coast and Midwest run. So I guess talk about mm-hmm. that tour and everything you got going on with Kings of Thrash.
Sure. Yeah. You know, that idea came to me when I was at the Chiller Theater in New Jersey back in, I guess it was Halloween of 2021. And people were bringing me Killing Is My Business records to sign, of all, you know, original Combat versions to, you know, the latest or the Final Kill. And, you know, of course, we started the tour back there, I think at Hammer Jacks in Baltimore. And we, you know, kind of, so that was 1985 when we were on tour with Exciter. And it just hit me, you know, it's, I wanted to play the album when we reissued the Final Kill. I thought it would have been cool to go out one night only and do that. Of course, we saw last year Metallica, you know, when they were doing their 40th anniversary, they did all these little pop-up shows. And, mm-hmm. you know, that was kind of what I wanted to do with that record. Just right. One night only, go play the Metro in Chicago, you know, like mm-hmm. just some place where we'd actually played the record, you know. And sure. It just got poo-pooed, you know? So I was like, well, fuck it. I'm going to go do it, you know? Because right. I know the songs. You know? And, you know, the truth of it is, you know, I've watched over the years, you know, that record has just kind of been this, you know, this sleeper cult classic, you know? And again, mm-hmm. it's like a horror movie, you know? And it just sort of sleeps in the background and sort of creeps up. And all of a sudden, it's this one that everybody just can't wait to get up, you know, to get a hold of again. And you know, I'd actually called Chris Paul and said, hey dude, let's go play Killing and B-Cells. And he agreed. And then he called me back 15 minutes later and goes, dude, I can't do that. I don't have enough time in my schedule to do that. You know, and I said, just relax. Well, the time will come, you know? So I called the promoter here in town and we got the wheels turning on it. And, you know, we were thinking about doing it in early 2022, but we knew it was going to happen. It just needed to find the right time, you know, and Jeff had called me to go out to jam at the Whiskey. They do the Ultimate Jam Night. Chuck Wright from Quiet Riot is part of that. As are some of the people that work with the Bullet Boys. So they put together, you know, a tribute to the Big Four. And Jeff said, dude, you want to come out and jam? I said, fuck yeah, man. So I booked my own flight, as I always do. You know, I just pay my own way, get on a plane and just go. Get in the room, get on the stage, be part of the action. And, you know, because from there came Kings of Thrash. I mean, that night, Chaz Leon was our singer and our guitar player. So he's part of the group. Fred Aching, who plays in the Bullet Boys, he'd actually played with some of the Slayer, you know, ensembles that had performed later in the night. So we saw him play. I said, that guy's friggin' good. So we grabbed him to be part of Kings of Thrash. So, you know, yeah, just being in the room, you know, we sort of built the band off that night. And
sure.
Now here we are. Yeah.
Yeah. And it gives fans, and this is probably a perfect lead in to Bob. It gives even older fans that didn't discover the band until Peace Sells, which is probably, I would probably still say is most of the fans, you know, they didn't really get to hear Killing Is My Business live, but there was a few people that were involved in you guys' world back in that time that did. And obviously Bob Nalbandian was one of them. You know, there was just that little collection of guys that were so supportive long before there was an internet, you know, long before when you had to send a pen pal a letter or whatever to talk about, you got to see this band coming out. So why don't we go there, David, and talk about as early as you remember meeting Bob and that whole community, not only Bob, but the community of journalists that really helped put you guys and Metallica and, you know, other bands on the map.
Well, Bob was Dave's friend. You know, so I moved to L.A. from Minnesota. I land there, you know, June 1, 1983. Land into this whole other scene. Of course, the US Festival just happened. Randy Rhoads had passed away, so there's a lot of excitement around sadness, but then also excitement around, you know, there's Brad Gillis about Night Rangers on the map because he played on Speak of the Devil with Ozzy.
Right.
You know, Ozzy getting his musicians out of LA put a lot of people on the map, you know, so suddenly Jakey Lee. So now we've heard of Rat, you know, cause he was in Mickey Rat, I guess, you know, so now all of a sudden we know of Rat, we know of Night Ranger, we know of all these bands just from the guitar players. And of course from Randy and then Rudy Sarzo, we know of Quiet Riot. So, you know, three bands in particular popped on the radar just because of the musicians Ozzy cut in his band. And for kids like me in the Midwest, where, if you say pre-internet, you know, news traveled very slow by way of Circus Magazine, you know, these Hip Raider, these kind of things. maybe Metal Edge was out at that time. But, you know, so mostly, you know, grocery store, rock magazine. So now I'm in L.A. I meet Dave. This whole other underground scene is happening, of which, of course, Metallica is the leader. Because, you know, Motley, Quiet Riot, Rats, Wasp, these guys, you know, they had taken off on the runway, and you know, we're on their way now. This next scene, which would be known as thrash metal some years later, it was the deal, as was Yngwie. You know, Mike Varney had just brought Yngwie over from Sweden, and he was playing in Ron Keel's band Steeler. And I remember we went out to go see Steeler. I think they opened for Loudness. Loudness had was playing their very first show in America at the Country Club. So just, you know, man, I couldn't have gotten there at a better time, you know. And of course, Dave,
right,
in his, you know, kicking around the idea for his next band post Metallica, me and my friend Greg Handovit, you know, joined forces with him. We, you know, we through, you know, the early, Dave is writing stuff, but during the rehearsals, and then we decided to call the band Megadeth. You know, that was the impetus of forming our band. So, you know, a lot of excitement around Dave, what his next step was going to be, you know. And Bob being one of the, you know, one of those excitable forces. You know, we all know Bob, always happy, always excited, right, always positive. Mm-hmm. So me and Dave, we go down to meet Bob. I seem to think it was Redondo Beach. We literally go do the interview with Bob on the beach. You know, I was like sun tanning out on the beach, you know, and which is what was so memorable about it. And that's why I'll always remember Bob. He's like, it was very bizarre to do a freaking heavy metal magazine interview on the beach in California. Shouldn't it be dark and satanic? No, it's sunny. So there we are. And so Bob, of course, so Bob in Southern Cal, Ron Quintana up in the Bay Area. Of course, there's the book. I have it here, you know, Murder in the Front Row, Brian Liu.
Oh, sure.
Cool. Brian, Dave actually had Brian kind of running our quote unquote fan club, meaning he oversaw a post office box where the letters would show up.
right.
And he'd send them down to us. You know, Metal Maria, who of course has Adrenaline PR, so, you know, big league publicist now. She was a big Dave saw him play with Metallica out of the, you know, in the East Coast before they signed with Megaforce Records, like your t-shirt says. Mm-hmm. So all these people, you know, East Coast, West Coast, Bernard Doe from Metal Forces was in the UK. And, you know, Lars, and I think because he was from Denmark, you know, he understood the international connection that needed to happen. You know, Dave told me that Lars's, you know, first kind of mantra or mindset with Metallica was to be the, you know, the US Motorhead, right? I think that was kind of the original dream for him, right? So, you know, he understood that, you know, you had to get your music out to these people. So the Bob Nelbandians of the world, and in particular Bob, you know, they knew that when you got a demo, the No Life to Leather demo for Metallica being sort of the crown jewel of success, you know, you get those demos out, the buzz spreads. You know, today if you did that, you're basically giving your songs away on the internet, right? You'll never get them back. But back in those days, you wanted people to spread the demo around, because it's how Bob and Ron and Bernardo and all these guys, and Malcolm Dome, who was writing for Kerrang and various things, you know, you wanted that buzz, because that's what got the likes of Megaforce and Combat Records interested in your band. It was sort of early A&R PR, you know. So we did the same thing. We had a three song demo of I think it was Love to Death, Mechanics and Skull Beneath the Skin, I think, if I'm correct. And so we had the same thing. We got a little play on KMET, which was the other, KMET and KLOS were the two stations in LA, and KMET had like a Saturday night heavy metal hour. That was where I first heard Queen of the Reich by Queensryche. You know, they would play Armored Saint, who were coming up the ranks, had just gotten signed, I guess, to Chrysalis. Warrior, Fighting for the Earth, you know, these, these were the things that were buzzing around in the underground. And of course, Megadeth, you know, being certainly one of the fastest, more ferocious ones. And a lot of excitement, of course, for Dave at, you know, post Metallica. So, you know, we got to start our band, you know, a few rungs up the ladder, you know, because Dave had already paid some of those dues with Metallica, you know, playing around the Southern Cal area. But, you know, we never played the Sunset Strip or any of that stuff. I mean, Dave not only did he not want to, because he knew he hated the whole pay to play thing, which I agree with. But so we had to play these like outlier punk rock theaters, you know, like the Balboa Theater and all these kind of, you know, these grungy punk rock theaters were like Black Flag and shit would play, you know, because that, and it was great because, you know, there's no chairs, you know, the thrashers could fucking mosh and, you know, stage dive. And, you know, it was, you know, the audience was part of the act. I mean, I think we were as entertained as they were.
Nice. Cool.
Yeah. Well, so Dave, I mean, I, you know, one of the things about Bob, you know, is obviously everyone knows, like I say, he's very connected to the Megadeth camp. And one of the things I'm going to bring up just right here for a second is this was obviously he was put into the Rust in Peace book that came out a few years ago. And obviously, it, you know, Bob obviously introduced Marty Friedman into the band. That's one of the things that he's, you know, more well known for with in terms of his relation with the camp. But, you know, one of the things it says here in the book and right on the quotes right there, it says that he was still one of the band's oldest and truest friends, you know, really up until, I mean, you know, these today or, you know, up until at least this book was put out. So what was it about, you know, Bob that really made, you know, that made him one of the quote unquote, you know, most truest fans, excuse me, friends of the band over the years? I mean, obviously you guys have worked and been connected with so many people, you know, being a Megadeth. What was it about Bob that stood out amongst everybody else, in your opinion?
Well, you know, you liked Bob before, as soon as you saw him, you liked him because he had just like there. Got the big electric smile, walks in the room, he's happy. You know, the world could be falling apart, everything could be going to hell in a handbasket. Bob walks in and suddenly everything's okay. You know what I mean? Because he was just that guy. He was eternally optimistic and happy. You know, I don't think the guy had a mean bone or an enemy anywhere. Everybody liked him. He was a fan of everything and everyone. I mean, a genuine fan, not a schmoozy guy so he could get backstage and drink your beer, you know, because there was plenty of those guys too. But, you know, like the guy who just really, you always let Bob in the room, you know what I mean? Because he was just, he was genuine, he was heartfelt. And maybe it's because he's from Orange County and, you know, he wasn't part of the hustle of the Sunset Strip, you know, because when you live there, and I had to learn how to do it too, you got to learn how to hustle and bullshit and get your way in the room. And you know what I mean? It's just, it's that thing. And I think Bob not being from that culture, but truly being, you know, a fan who like all of us bought your Iron Maiden records or whatever it is, you took them home, you listened to them on your stereo and you just became a fan. I mean, he was that guy. And I think that's why everybody liked him. Of course, you know, Brian Slagle, from Metal Blade Records, you know, he was another one of the guys, not a journalist, but a label guy, Johnny Z, you know, on the East Coast, you know, so there's all these players in the scene of that helped this thing get off the ground and become what it was. And it was all fan driven. It wasn't money driven. It wasn't profit motive. It was just for the love of the scene and to be part of something. And I think that's why when we did the Big Four, you know, back in, you know, 2010 and 2011, that's why it was even so special, is because this was a family reunion, not just of the four bands, but of everybody that was a part of it. You know, such a celebration. So, you know, I think with Bob, look, we interviewed him for the Nick Menza movie that will hopefully we'll get that out next year. Well, that was the last time I saw Bob, and that would have been January. It was a year ago, January of 2022. When we were filming the interviews, and he gave us some great stories. And, you know, he, as happy-go-lucky as Bob is, when he spoke with authority because he was there. He knew what he was talking about.
Sure.
And you're right. I always forget about the Marty Friedman thing, ironically, because he was good friends with our manager at the time, Ron Lafitte, who, again, was another guy, was friends with Armored Saint. He was the tour manager for the Wasp Metallica Armored Saint tour. He tour managed Armored Saint. He grew up with those guys. You know, Ron worked his way up into, you know, into management, you know, wanted just give anything to manage Megadeth. I actually convinced Dave he should be our manager because he'd always come to me. You know, guys would come to me to get to Dave, you know. So after a few, you know, hangs with Ron, I love Ron. And, you know, Ron was like Dave, you know, or I mean like Bob, like just one of the happy faces. You'd always let him in the room, you know, and so, you know, Ron managed us from 89 through into the, you know, Euthanasia record. So, you know, our big years, you know, and a lot of that success certainly goes to Ron. You know, he knew how to captain the ship, you know. So I guess he's the one who, you know, hit Ron and said, hey, you know, can we give Marty an audition? So and then Ron, you know, got that over to me and Dave. And in fact, it was funny that when it happened, because we were actually up, Ron was part of Lippman and Kahane. And Rob Kahane, his big artist was George Michael at the top of his career, you know, late 80s.
Right,
90s.
Sure.
I think he managed him maybe through his whole career. But so that was the big thing. And the Lippman brothers, they managed producers. That's how Mike Klink got into producer, okay. Rest in Peace, because they managed, okay. Mike Klink. So Ron was in there. He worked in their office. He was, you know, and that was right across the street from Tower Records there. So we were cutting the demos for the Rust in Peace album in December of 89. And it was just me, Dave, and Nick Menza. We didn't have a good, just like So Far So Good So What, where it was me, Dave, and Chuck, you know, and then
right.
We brought Jeff in to play some solos. He joined the band. Well, we hired Chris Poland to come in and play some solos. Just if nothing, as a placeholder, you know, we knew he wasn't going to rejoin the band per se. But and then we went down on a break. We went a couple floors down to the Lippman and Kahane office, down to Ron's office. And we saw Dragon's Kiss and the Cacophony record sitting on Ron's desk. And I remember we picked him up and goes, so what's up with this guy? You know, and Ron said, he goes, dude, I've been telling you guys, we should give this guy an audition. And me and Dave was just like, why not? We just tried 20 other guys. It didn't work. You know, we got nothing to lose, you know, because we knew we were going to be going to the studio in a couple of months to record the Rest in Peace record. So that's how it happened. And we knew of Marty because from Hawaii, because I remember Bailoff from Exodus, you know, Dave is friends with those guys. So Bailoff and Exodus's manager, Adam, forgot his last name, but they came down when Dave and I first met. We were living on Sycamore, and Bailoff would come down. And I remember him just sitting over in the corner, smoking bongs like a Buddha, you know, and going, dude, this is friendly, man. And that was just being friendly, you know. It was like, oh, this is friendly, you know. And we're listening to Hawaii, Fitting the Pendulum, and all this stuff. So I you know, so we knew of Marty. And I think the way Marty really won the audition is he hired a guitar tech. You know, Marty did it right. Marty was so broke he didn't have a penny to his name, but he scrounged together a favor or enough money to have a guitar tech come in, set all this shit up. So when the Marty could walk in like a rock star, pick up his guitar and play. And right. And I think just his whole professional approach to it won him the gig as much as anything else. It's like, okay, this guy gets what this level is, you know, like this isn't some sure. garage band. Because, I mean, when we did our first round of auditions with me and Dave and Nick Menza, I mean, guys would come in. And I remember one guy comes in and he plugs his guitar in and, you know, he's got his shirt tucked in, his pants pulled up, and like, okay, this look is all wrong, right? White jeans. And we're like, he definitely didn't dress for the gig, right? So again, you know, you kind of assess the guy when he's walking in the door. All right, is this guy even thinking like we do? And he stands there and he puts his hands on his hips and goes, okay, so show me the songs. We're like, show you the songs. Like, you should know the songs. This is the audition. Yeah. This isn't where we, you know. You're supposed to blow our minds right now with how awesome you are, you know? And we had another guy come in and he was like doing his Ritchie Blackmore thing, swinging his cord at his guitar and doing all this, like, you know, like take it down a notch, dude. You're like way, way stepping out of your lane. So, I mean, right. We had all these kind of guys. So, you know, to see Marty come in, you know, and just do it right, you know, looked the part, played the part, you know, knew the music as good as anybody could, not having been in the room when the music was written, because there's a lot of detail to the music. So, you know, again, speaking back to Bob's instincts, he knew like, this is the guy, you know? So, you right. know, that's, you know, so again, big, big kudos. We'll give that one to Bob for sure. You know?
Absolutely. Well, and, you know, over the course of the 40 years, Dave, the biggest thing, and we're hearing this from everybody, and I think Matt and I both echo it as well. As long as I've known Bob, which is a whole lot less than you have, same guy, you know, never changed, totally. never changed in attitude and spirit. I mean, to his dying day, positive, yeah. didn't want people to worry about him. You know, I mean, you know, I told you, and the first thing you were like, first you said to me was, what happened? Was he sick? You know, he didn't want people to worry. He wasn't that guy. He didn't want credit for anything. He didn't want, all he wanted to do was be part of a scene and help it grow and
right.
and just be cool with people. And I think that might be a good place for us to wrap this up with is, you know, for you, you obviously knew Bob and have been friends yeah. with Bob for 40 years and have done his movies. He's obviously had huge influence on your career with Marty and just in general, right. his promotion of Megadeth and other stuff. So to wrap it up, why don't you give us kind of a summation of your, you know, your 40 year history with Bob Nalbandian?
Sure. Well, look, you know, you texted me. I was with James Rivera. It was the night, it was December 30th, when James and I were doing a show in Houston. And I was literally sitting at dinner before the show, and your text shows up. And they said, Bob Nalbandian passed away. I'm like, what the hell? What happened? You know, because again, I saw him in January. We filmed his segment. We actually got in the car, drove down the street to Starbucks. We got caught up. We were bullshitting and just hanging out. He was so positive to me. He was like, man, he goes, you just keep going. Everything you're doing is just great, man. You're on point. Just keep at it. You're, you know, everything that you're doing, mm-hmm. with Lucid, the movie and all this other stuff. So he was so encouraging to me in this next season of my life to just keep going, man. Just stay the course and genuine, not like trying to just, you know, fluff me up, but mm-hmm. like really genuine, like, dude, you're on it, you know, keep going, you know? So, and that to me was, you know, real friendship. You know, not just as a, you know, as a former Megadeth guy, but just as me, you know, Bob and David, you know, so that's the genuineness that from him that he had. And, you know, I can't remember, you know, Drew Fortier, when he was going through his cancer, he said that Bob reached out to him. I guess had revealed to him that he was going through, you know, his own, you know, battle, at the time. And I guess he'd relocated up north to Northern California to be with his parents.
Right.
And then you kind of gave me the backstory as well, Chris, you know, that day you texted me, and I was like, God, I was trying to remember. I was like, did he even tell me this? I can't remember. Or maybe he just alluded, like, yeah, I'm going to move back up north. You know, he was very, again, like you said, and it wasn't that he was hiding anything. He just didn't want anybody to worry about him. He's like,
yeah,
just, you know, don't worry about me. You know, he was so selfless. And I think that probably sums up Bob. If there's one word, he was selfless. You know, he never had any of this stuff so that he could take the spotlight on him. He never tried to step into our spotlight. He always knew his place.
No, just to wrap up about Bob, you know, he, I was saying, if there's one word to describe him, it would be selfless. You know, mm-hmm. he never did any of this for any self promotion. He wasn't like trying to pimp his YouTube numbers, you know, trying to right. improve his, you know, his position yeah. in the business. He was just completely selfless in everything that he did. He did it just out of the pure love and the passion. And, you know, I think, you know, for me, he was just such a supporter of me personally, you know, and it wasn't, you know, what I had to be in Megadeth or not, you know, it wasn't that. It was just, he just told me, man, you keep going. Everything you're doing is on point. Just stay the course. You're doing great right now. But yeah, when he, you know, I think when he, you know, he never mentioned that I can remember anything about having cancer. You know, I think he just said he might be relocating back up to North to be with his parents. And he didn't, and it was because I think he really honestly didn't want anybody to worry about him. And, you know, there's no shame. I don't think he was embarrassed or anything. He was just like, you just keep going, David, you do your thing, man. And just, you know, and don't worry about me. You know, I'm good over here. So I think that was so shocking about that when, you know, I got the text from you, Chris, that he had passed. But, you know, Bob, I think, you know, he lived a great life. He was a man of integrity. He finished strong. Everybody, I'm sure every one of these podcasts or comments that I ever saw online, everybody just loves the guy, you know, and, mm-hmm. And what a great way to finish off your time on earth, you know, of leaving that kind of a legacy behind, just being selfless and just always one to come and help and pitch in and just be part of the goodwill.
Right. And I, the irony of irony, at least to me, no matter what level anybody's been at that has said something online about Bob, not a bad word, none. From fans to, you know, the highest heights of rock stars, everybody has positive things. And that's rare these days. You know, that's very rare.
No, exactly. I mean, yeah, you know, even for journalists, because journalists have usually shit talked somebody or given a 2-star review on some album, you know, they've done something, right? You know, Bob just always shot straight. And, you know, I always forget, you know, Bob would always call me to, you know, to participate in his movies he was doing. He hired me to narrate several of his films. You know, it was always just, you know, he would just always think of me, you know, and it just randomly out of nowhere, some email or call would come from Bob. Hey, do you want to be part of this? Or we're filming this. And I'd always give him access to the shows and get him in. And, you know, I remember filming stuff in parking lot of the arena in San Jose, just so we could get the content, you know, and just, you know, whatever it took, you know.
Well, David, obviously you're busy, man, but we definitely appreciate you taking a little bit of time out to remember Bob and, you know, obviously good travels for you with Kings of Thrash. And, you know, I'm sure Bob and his family and all his friends will appreciate that you took some time, man.
Of course. Awesome. See you guys.
Awesome. Thanks a lot, David.